Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast about better understanding other people and better understanding ourselves. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. On today's episode, I'll be talking to psychology researcher Paul Delfabro about cryptocurrency and how some people's crypto trading can be a form of problem gambling. We talk about addiction in general, about how the internet can contribute to online addictions, about day trading, about video game addiction, and more. A little bit about Paul from his professor page at the University of Adelaide in Australia. Paul has worked at the University of Adelaide since 2001, and he lectures in the areas of learning theory as well as methodology and statistics. His principal research interests are in the area of behavioral addictions, especially gambling and technology, as well as child protection and out-of-home care. Most of his research work involves statistical analysis of cross-sectional and longitudinal surveys and experimental studies. I found Paul's research because I've been interested in doing an episode about cryptocurrency and crypto-related psychology for a while. A paper from 2021 by Paul, Daniel King, and Jennifer Williams was titled "The Psychology of Cryptocurrency Trading: Risk and Protective Factors." To quote from that paper, "We review the specific psychological mechanisms that we propose to be particular risk factors for excessive crypto trading, including overestimations of the role of knowledge or skill, the fear of missing out, aka FOMO, preoccupation, and anticipated regret," end quote. Another paper Paul worked on was titled "Cryptocurrency Trading, Gambling, and Problem Gambling." One interesting thing about Paul's work is that, for the purposes of studying it from a psychology point of view and a gambling behavior point of view, he's had to learn a lot about cryptocurrency. For example, that first study I mentioned had an in-depth analysis of the various risks involved with crypto and where those risks came from and why they existed. I mention this because Paul isn't just knowledgeable about the psychology aspects of this, but he also seems quite knowledgeable about cryptocurrency in general. Apart from cryptocurrency-related work, Paul has also worked on research regarding gambling addiction in general, including video game addiction, and has worked on conspiracy theory psychology. You can learn more about Paul Delfabro by searching for his name and finding his University of Adelaide page or his Google Scholar page. A note about this talk, I'm pretty ignorant about cryptocurrency, so if I get any phrasing about it wrong, that's why. And hopefully this is clear, but just in case, my choice of focusing on the more gambling-related and addiction-related aspects of cryptocurrency shouldn't be interpreted as me having a negative view of cryptocurrency. It's just that this is a psychology podcast, so I wanted to choose something psychology-related to focus on. And that seemed to be one of the main things to focus on. As this episode relates to gambling, I wanted to briefly mention my own gambling-related work. If you didn't already know, I'm the author of some well-known books on poker behavior, also known as Poker Tells. My books have been called the best work on the subject by many poker players, both amateurs and professional players. My first book has been translated into 8 languages. If you play poker, you might like checking out my site, readingpokertells.com, and reading the reviews. Okay, enough of the shameless self-promotion. Here's the talk with Paul Delfabro. Hi, Paul. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Yes. So you've done a wide range of psychology research, and including a lot of things that are interesting to me personally, including problem gambling and addiction to technology and conspiracy theory beliefs. So I'm curious, what drives your research interests, and are there certain themes that you're drawn to, and what are those?
Yeah, my interest in gambling probably has a number of different influences. I think my principal area of research or teaching interest has always been in learning and behavior. So I've always been interested in how very simple habitual behaviors are maintained by schedules of reinforcement, simple stimuli, and those sorts of things. So slot machine gambling was something that's always interested me because it seemed to be a natural human extension or some of the simple behaviors we see in animals. So I've always had an interest from my undergraduate days in that type of simple behavior. I guess from a personal point of view, I had an uncle who owned a slot machine in a boys' room many years ago when we used to play it when I was a kid. And I used to see these machines in various locations and be curious about them. And I think that spurred my interest from an early age. And then when Australia started to introduce these machines, particularly our state started to introduce these machines in the mid-1990s, at a time I started to do research, it almost all those I guess, earlier interests and the potential for this to be an interesting topic for research and, I guess, regulation and just general public interest all came together for me to start doing that research in the 1990s. And I think what I really like about it is it provides an opportunity to apply some of the more abstract principles we learn in psychology to real-world behavior. Mm-hmm. So I think all those things coming together created that interest in gambling. Conspiracy theories, I think, are a topic I've come to a bit later. I think it's one of those topics which many people have views about. I think there are, as a general citizen, I think we should always be thinking about what government is doing. And we certainly know that government doesn't always tell us the truth about things, and that's for often quite legitimate reasons. We obviously don't release all the current cabinet papers in Australia when things are happening, but we find out 20 years later what decisions the government's making. I think also it's an interest that came about through the simple fact that I was a person who was born in the late 60s, who grew up in the 80s, when Oliver Stone was making conspiracy movies, mm-hmm. and there's always been a general interest, I guess, in this era about the JFK assassination and other similar stories. And I think with gambling, you're looking a lot at irrational beliefs as well about the nature of outcomes. And given I also had a background in finance and economics, I think all these things sort of came together for me to have a curiosity about why people believe certain extravagant beliefs, particularly when there's not a lot of evidence to back them up.
Yeah, that's interesting. Actually, as you were talking about that, I just made the connection. There are a good amount of similarities you could find between gambling addiction and other irrational behaviors and conspiracy theories. Like there could be some similar kind of addictive kind of things there that affect people's behavior. Would you say that's true?
Oh, for sure. I think even though gambling is very driven by simple conditioning and very behaviorally based mechanisms, there certainly is an element of irrational beliefs. So there's been studies where you get people to verbalize their thoughts about gambling outcomes, so particularly when they play slot machines, and you find that quite a lot of the information or things they say indicate the presence of quite common cognitive biases. So you certainly do see beliefs such as people believe the machines are pre-programmed to do certain things, or people try to develop sort of personal relationships with machines, believing they can beat the odds. Now, there is some sort of, like all these sort of things, some skerrick of truth there. We know, for example, there's talk of concepts such as Easter eggs, people that are hidden things that people might do, the programmers put in there to enable you to win. But in general, the average person's not going to know anything like that. So to believe that you've got any control over these chance-based devices is, of course, entirely irrational.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there could be some connections the other way too, where there can be elements of people getting maybe some ego boost or other kind of pleasures from beliefs in conspiracy theories, even though some extreme beliefs in conspiracy theories can be quite self-destructive in a similar way to addictive behaviors. And yet there might be like different kinds of rewards for those kinds of beliefs. Do you see some of that too?
Yeah, in my lectures, I talk a lot about the illusion of control and some of these common cognitive beliefs and what are the psychological mechanisms that maintain them. So part of it is motivational. People like to believe they're in control of their lives. People often don't like uncertainty. People also have brains which are hardwired to find connections between things. So we have this natural tendency to want to see control. Mm-hmm. And we often tend to do that most when we're facing uncertainty or emotional turmoil. So if we think back to some of the major crises of the world, think of 9/11 and others, the remarkable number of erroneous beliefs that emerged during that period, simply because people were looking for ways to explain the uncertainty to deal with their anxiety. And we know that with many gamblers, they are quite anxious people sometimes, has been seen in some cases as a form of coping, which is an anxiety-based behavior, which is actually amenable to people having more of these sorts of beliefs.
Maybe you could talk a bit about how some people's cryptocurrency trading has similarities or an overlap with problem gambling. And you talked in a couple of your papers about how, crypto, for example, has a lot in common with day trading. And then for some day traders, they day trade in ways that can be, seen as problem gambling. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yes, I guess the preface to this argument is that over the years, we've been experiencing what's called technological convergence or digital convergence, which essentially means that in the past, we were able to compartmentalize different activities. We would go to the drive-in or a cinema to see movies. We would play games somewhere else. We'd gamble somewhere else. Of course, what's happening now is that there's an increasing blurring of lines between different activities because you can essentially use the same device, the same technology to gain access to all these different activities. So over the years, there's certainly been increasing convergence of gaming and gambling. So we're seeing increasing number of gambling-like elements emerging in games. People often talk about loot boxes being one example of that. And increasingly, you're starting to see some elements of speculative trading starting to overlap a little bit with gambling. Now, cryptocurrency obviously is something that's been around for about a decade when Bitcoin was obviously came into being in 2009. But certainly in the last 5 years, particularly 2017, 2018, we had that bull run in the markets. It has become a much more well-known activity. It's still a very small proportion of the population actually engaged in this in any sort of regular form. I think some of the surveys probably overestimate how many people are really doing it. But research that has been done suggests that those people who do engage in more speculative trading, whether it be day trading or whether it's crypto, do share some characteristics with gambling. In other words, if you look at if you do a survey administering measures of gambling, trading, crypto, you'll find that statistically people who have an interest in gambling and even those who might have some problems with gambling tend to be attracted to the sorts of activities which share the characteristics of gambling. And so people who are problem gamblers who play games will tend to be more likely to spend money on games and buy loot boxes and games. They similarly will also be more likely to engage in speculative trading with crypto, which doesn't have to be entirely that speculative if people take a longer term view. However, statistically, you would say that someone who's already quite a regular gambler is probably more vulnerable to the more speculative side of crypto trading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like the more frequent the trades are, or the exchanges, the more likely it becomes that someone might, become addicted to that rush, it seems like. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, the term rush is often used in more traditional addiction models where you're talking about drugs and those sorts of things. And I would say that some rush and adrenaline would play a role in trading. I think people would certainly get quite a arousal response when they see a particular coin taking off very quickly, and that certainly would be the case with trading as well. So one of the things which has become a very important part of addiction research, at least behavioral addiction research, which starts with gambling and has progressed to gaming and other activities, is that we do realize that the technology does play a very important role in the uptake of these activities. So we know that the level of involvement, the extent to which you can engage and impulsive behavior is very much influenced by the accessibility of the behavior or the activity. So that if you have a 24-hour market which is available on a very convenient app which you can take everywhere, that does increase the opportunities for being preoccupied with the activity, monitoring the prices, maybe making impulse decisions about what you're going to buy and sell. So it's certainly the case that the internet and the ability to carry it around your pocket has made these sorts of activities potentially, more common and potentially more addictive.
Yeah, the thing that really strikes me about this is the internet and internet-based technologies have just given us so much power at our fingertips, just so much control, like whether it's the ability to gamble at any time, the ability to trade stocks or crypto at any time, the power to run up a bunch of debts on credit cards, the ability to imitate other people and use fake names, the ability to watch porn at a moment's notice, the ability to meet up with people easily. It's like these are all really powerful abilities that the internet gives us. And with that power comes a lot of temptation to engage in bad and destructive aspects of ourselves. And in a way, I think that, just simply did not exist until pretty recently in the internet age. And I'm curious if you agree with all that and see the internet as generally amplifying addictive behaviors. And maybe you answered that a little bit, but maybe you could go into a little bit more detail.
Yeah, you could certainly argue that what the internet does is it amplifies. It's a bit like alcohol on mood. It amplifies things which previously existed. And so one of the interesting things about the internet, I know I talk about in some of my technology and psychology courses, is that with some behaviors, you could argue they've been around forever or for a very long time. So pornography, gambling, various behaviors have always been there. And to the extent that the internet is used for those behaviors, you could argue it's more of a vehicle to make the activity easier to access rather than necessarily creating the activity. Mm-hmm. Whereas some forms of behavior, such as, you know, compulsively checking social media, spending all your time on Facebook and tweeting all the time, is a behavior which has really only come about as a result of this technology. It's hard to see as having a similar historical antecedent. And so you could almost argue that addiction to social media, while it might have had some, you know, rough sort of parallels in the past, it really is something, a phenomenon of the last decade. Mm-hmm. And so you could argue that behavior in particular, particularly and to the extent that social media is used to fuel these other behaviors, that's really a phenomenon that's occurred in the last few years. And you could argue probably the 2000s when that really started to take off. And with the advent of, you know, mobile devices, which enable you to have the internet on your phone walking around, that of course takes it to another level in that you're able to do it at any time, any place.
Mm-hmm. And you've studied addiction to video games, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that. What are some of the interesting things you found in that area?
Yeah, it's a topic which my colleague Daniel King has probably done most of the work. I tend to do most of the gambling work, but certainly gaming has been something of interest to me. I've played video games like many people right back to the 80s. My teenage years were very much like the show Stranger Things, and I remember the days of, you know, the noisy arcades and those simple handheld games, and how the gradual console world developed. There's been a lot of discussion internationally about gaming and whether it's can be a form of addiction, and the World Health Organization had quite a lot of discussions about this topic, and looking at ways whether or not, you know, internet gaming disorder should be a valid addiction. And of course, it has been recognized in some of the measurement consensus as a valid form of addiction, and they tend to map it to what we know about gambling. So people who might be have addiction to gaming, you know, spend too much time doing it, they're preoccupied, they tend to spend an inordinate amount of time doing it. When it comes to the harms associated with it, it's not quite the same as gambling in that people don't spend quite so much money. They're not usually at financial risk from it, but what they tend to do is just run their health down. So they spend a lot of time eating bad food, not sleeping, you know, not studying, working. So gaming tends to sort of eat away at people's other activities and their health. I think that seems to be the principal consequence. We have encountered some clinical cases where people have just simply spent, you know, weeks in their room, really coming out very infrequently, or even going to the bathroom, you know, to continue to gaming. And we know that's a phenomenon that's perhaps been documented to a greater degree in some of the major Asian countries, such as South Korea and Japan in particular, where young people just disappear and you don't even know they're alive, apart from the fact that the tray comes out with no food on it. And so that's gaming is certainly a topic which has been of increasing interest to researchers. And we find these days it's when parents ring us up about young people, it's usually about gaming and not about gambling anymore.
So getting to the cryptocurrency, I don't have much opinion about cryptocurrency in general, and I see the positive aspects of it that many people talk about, its decentralized nature, but I also just don't have much opinions because it seems very uncertain to me what will happen with it. You know, there's just so many factors, it seems to me, for the whole industry, let alone, you know, specific coins. But one thing I notice with some people, it seems like there's a high amount of certainty from some people, almost like a faith-like certainty that some people have, you know, acting as if this is a certainty that A, cryptocurrency will be the future, or B, a specific coin will be the future. Clearly, not everyone who says those kinds of things actually has a faith-like belief, I think, but it seems like a lot of people really do. And I'm curious if you see that kind of, what I view as an unreasonable amount of certainty in such things. Do you see that kind of certainty, faith-like certainty, as being related to addictive behaviors?
Yeah, not really. I guess what I've observed from looking at the crypto market is that it has changed dramatically over the last 4 years. I think there are some certainties, I think, to do with this technology, as there were with the internet, I think, and many of the debates which were raised about the internet back in the late 1990s and even early 2000s, there are some people still talking about the internet as not really being something that was going to be viable for many purposes, which we now, of course, commonly use it for every day. I mean, going back even further, there were people saying that airplanes weren't going to be very useful in warfare back in the early 1920s. I think some certainties are that blockchain's definitely here to stay. I think Bitcoin as a something with a established protocol, limited supply, fairly widespread ownership, I think is probably here to stay. And some of the major Ethereum is probably another one, which I think is probably here to stay. I think we could certainly say that blockchain and cryptocurrency are going to be part of the future. And what we're seeing in the last 4 years, there's been a major shift from much of the crypto market being all about speculative retail investors, which we saw particularly in 2017-18, to in the last 2 years, massive institutional involvement. So at the moment, we've seen a market whereby I think there's a Bitcoin conference going on in Miami at the moment, and apparently the whole first day is all just big institutions. And you look at Google Trends, hardly any retail investors are really searching the word Bitcoin and crypto. It's all institutional investors. So we've sort of gone from it being a very speculative fringe activity to one which I think is now being picked up by the smart money. But the issue still is that it's still a very new and in many cases unregulated market, whereby there are some things which are now a bit more certain. But there is still a considerable number of scams and uncertainty, and certainly not a lot of consumer information out there, which therefore means that retail investors, when they do come back into the market, are going to be vulnerable to the same sorts of speculation and problems that we've seen in previous years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess when I'm talking about some of the extreme certainty is things people will say, things like Bitcoin is definitely going to 100,000, per Bitcoin in the next whatever length of time, or this will be the coin of the future, very, very extreme belief in things that I think are just unknown. I have no doubt that cryptocurrency or the blockchain kind of technology will be around for a while. It's just I'm talking about the very confident beliefs, which seem to me either to be kind of almost cult-like or just, I think some people are just, as people do, they'll express confidence in order to convince others of their beliefs.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid observation of certainly what happened last year. I think there was a lot of one of the problems with this market, that there's not a lot of data points on which to draw comparisons, so that the Bitcoin markets tend to move in cycles every 4 years based on the halving. And so what you notice in the social media influencers is they often map what's going to happen based upon what's happened in the past. So they fall victim to the classic inductive logic, whereby they say, well, this is what's happened in the past, and they get these fancy charts out and map it, and they have these models.
Right, it's just such a short, it's such a short time frame, yeah.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So that there was, of course, anyone who's listening who knows about the crypto market will know that there was this guy called Plan B who had this Dr. Flow model and various other models that were convincing everyone he got right for several months, and then Bitcoin was going to go up to 100,000 or more by the end of the year. We're going to see this big bull run similar to 2017. Of course, it didn't happen. Even some of the top guys were caught out by it not happening, because so much of what happens in the market is dictated by larger macro factors rather than what happens on these charts. So it is certainly the case that you have influencers who make a lot of money from running their YouTube channels, and they want to keep their audience interested. They want to keep them motivated. This is quite often retail investors, although I would say at the moment people who are listening to the more serious ones tend to be probably more serious long-term investors. What you tend to find is when the market goes down and it's not doing so well, which is currently what we're seeing at the moment, you'll see a massive drop in the number of people watching these social influencers. And the more, I guess, fringe and more extreme ones who have less experience in investing in general tend to disappear from YouTube. And then when the market picks up again, suddenly the meme coins are all popping, and you suddenly see all these people coming back out of the woodwork. and promoting pretty limited speculative knowledge to inexperienced retail investors. But certainly I agree with the cult-like nature of some of the beliefs. I think there is a this is where it does overlap a little bit with the conspiracy beliefs. Just occasionally you see even some of the more experienced, very competent influencers, if you've watched some of them, they'll drop a few words here and there which indicate they might be sympathetic to some of the more extreme beliefs. So for example, I see sometimes the word name Rothschilds will be dropped, or they'll talk about bail-in as one of the things, you know, banks that you can lose your withdrawal or your deposits in banks if banks run into trouble. They push the inflation narrative very hard, that, you know, Bitcoin is a store of value against inflation. Well, in the last 12 months, you'd probably say it's probably done, over a decade, has done much better than gold. But however, I think in the short term, if Bitcoin's going up and down, I'm not sure how strong that narrative is. I think over a longer period, certainly like any other hard asset or any asset, you'd probably say, well, you want to have money in Bitcoin than cash over the next 5 years or 10 years. However, in the short term, when there's inflation, Bitcoin could go up and down. So you're not quite sure whether it's going to hold its value across 12 months. And this is, of course, the issue of using Bitcoin as a form of payment. If it goes up and down in value, I think this is what's been found in El Salvador, people might find it as a useful asset, but then there are problems if it goes down in value when you want to go and spend it. Now, this happens to Australians as well. I mean, we have our currency has dropped, you know, very low in previous periods. I don't want to say that I think Americans have probably never had the experience of having your currency suddenly worth about 40% less than what it was worth, you know, a few months earlier. Back in 2001, our Australian dollar was 47 US cents. And of course now it's, you know, mid 70s. So we have had a period of drops, significant drops in currency. And of course there are other people in the world who might, for whom the Bitcoin narrative might be stronger, like Argentina and other countries, Turkey, where you do have very significant depreciation in your currency. But certainly there are challenges with using cryptocurrency as a store of value, like a fiat currency, because one, you've got the issue of it, you know, potentially going down. The second issue is at the moment it's treated as an asset. So when you spend it and dispose of it, there are potential capital gains implications.
Right. How big a problem do you think, have you seen any data on how big a problem gambling is in cryptocurrency trading?
Yeah, I wouldn't think that cryptocurrency will be a major cause of problem gambling. If you look at Australia, for example, which has one of the highest rates of gambling expenditure, probably the highest per capita expenditure of gambling in the world, something like 70-80% of all problem gambling comes from slot machines. And that's because it's very attractive to both men and women of different ages, whereas cryptocurrency tends to attract a very narrow band of the population. So when you look at those who do it quite regularly, who put reasonable money into it, it tends to be younger males who are into it. I'd say that probably characterize 85% of the investors. And so you tend to have people who are already into it. What you find is that those sort of people tend to already gamble on sports. They gamble on casino games. They have a wider range of activity preferences. And so like with sports betting, even though it's the most, you know, probably the form of gambling which is growing the most, it's still a very small activity relative to the slot machines.
Mm-hmm. And so crypto made big gains, some of its biggest gains post-COVID. COVID hit in early 2020, and then in October of 2020, Bitcoin really took off in a large way. And I'm curious if you have any opinions on whether you saw any COVID-related psychological effects going on in terms of maybe COVID lockdowns and financial and existential stressors making people more likely to speculate and more likely to basically gamble, things like that.
Yeah, I think there's certainly an argument that people were thinking about changing their lives during the COVID period. I think it made people reevaluate their lives. I think many people have also reevaluated their views of government quite a bit during that period too. I think government doing some good things during the course of the pandemic, and also I think some very bad things. We've had some particularly extreme government behaviour in Australia, particularly in Victoria. We've seen some pretty extreme behaviour in Canada recently from governments. whereas other governments have been, I think China probably is an example now, whereas we've seen other countries take a more reasonable view. And so we've seen in some ways the best and worst of what government can offer in the last two decades. So many people, so the last 2 years, I think people have, you know, started to rethink the nature of the world and how they, you know, manage their finances. We know that people saved a lot of money during the COVID period. They also were given quite a lot of stimulus money. There's a lot of quantitative easing occurring during that period. So it would be the case that all the conditions were ripe for a, you know, an asset bubble where people would put money into renovating their house, buying shares, buying crypto. And that would certainly be the case that young people would be attracted to that. I think the growth in the Bitcoin price last year obviously had a lot of different causes. I mean, the halving of Bitcoin occurred in 2020, I think, or 2019. So it was sort of naturally going up anyway during that period. We also had all the stimulus money coming into the market, which would have pushed up the speculative trading. So I think there were a number of things which came together during that period to push up the price. At the moment, I think we're in a state of great uncertainty in the world about many aspects of finance. So it'll be interesting to see what plays out in the next couple of years.
I was curious: is there an increase when times are tough in general? Aren't there some studies that show like there's an increase in, you know, things like gambling and alcohol use and things like that? Or am I getting that wrong?
Yeah, I think that there's some evidence for that. I mean, during the COVID period, people didn't have much else to do. And in fact, alcohol consumption and gaming certainly increased dramatically during that period. It's difficult to know whether it's caused by the fact that people were bored, didn't have much else to do than stay at home and do it. So if you just imagine holding all things constant, that people drink a certain amount per week, and if all the pubs and clubs are closed during that period, where else would you drink that but then but at home? And so you obviously go to the bottle shop and buy drinks and take them home. And so it might be that's a, you know, if you're seeing greater alcohol purchases in people's budgets, that would just be a reflection of them rediverting their going out and having a drink money back home. And I think with the gambling, it's been the same. We've seen spikes in gambling activity in some of the states of Australia in recent months, but that could be because people had all that money saved away that they otherwise would have spent over a more gradual period. And it could be that they're spending their sort of need for going out in a more concentrated period.
Right. It's complex like most things. It's hard to boil it down to a single thing. So when you were talking about the sort of like the Rothschilds conspiracy theory kind of beliefs, one thing I have thought about cryptocurrency in that area is there can be an element of the sheer fact of investing money in something can change someone's thoughts and beliefs. You know, for example, if someone who's invested a good amount of money into cryptocurrency and then that there can be a psychological pressure to really start to believe in cryptocurrency, even though at first the inclination was, or the motivation was just to see it go up. But by hoping it goes up, you might start believing in the mission, and your beliefs might change. And to make an analogy, it might be like somebody who's a politically liberal person who places a big bet on Donald Trump winning the election for purely financial reasons. And then they actually start to somewhat hope a bit for Trump's win. And that hope, that feeling of hope might change their beliefs in some way, make them look at things from a different angle, maybe somewhat against their initial wishes. And as someone who's gambled on a few political events myself, I felt a little bit of this, finding myself looking at things from new perspectives or feeling emotionally pulled in kind of weird ways just solely due to the money I'd bet on something. And I'm curious if you see some of that in the cryptocurrency area, where I think there can be, because people hope for cryptocurrency to succeed, they might start resenting a bit the government forces or the social forces that are holding cryptocurrency back, that they perceive as holding cryptocurrency back, like people's idiocy for not getting it, things like this. And that can kind of foster kind of antisocial in some senses perspective. But I'm curious if you have thought about that angle of things, about how placing bets can change people's ideas.
I think that's very true. What you do see, once people have a financial investment or stake in a particular cryptocurrency, they become very defensive about it. They will engage in quite a bit of confirmation bias. They'll be looking around to read material or look at influencers who are backing up their views about that particular coin. They want to read stuff to validate the decision they've already made. And people talk about their membership or ownership in certain coins as almost like a form of club. So, you know, people who invest in Chainlink talk about themselves as being part of the Link Army, and you get, you know, I'm not sure that there are lunatics for Luna, Terra Luna. Yeah, people always feel like they belong to a club when they own a particular coin, and they get quite resentful when people criticize that coin, knowing that if it's been done by a leading influencer, that can potentially drop or suppress the price. Now, I think it's quite important to have objective analysis of even some of the good projects, which may well still be good projects longer term. But I think certainly it is irrational when people start to attack those who are providing fairly legitimate objective appraisals of technology. I think the crypto industry does have some having sort of been academic, sort of writing about it, you do see some, while you do see this sort of almost cult-like faith in the technology and the future sometimes, you do also see sometimes the frustration of some of the, you know, very well-informed tech guys when they get, they're faced with sort of quite obvious ignorance from politicians who are making very important decisions about the industry. I think there's always this classic, they always talk about the FUD associated with crypto, and one of them, of course, is that it facilitates crime, when in fact we know that it's very easy to track transactions on blockchain much more easily than it is with fiat currency, which is, of course, the vehicle of choice for most organized crime. And I guess the environmental FUD gets dug out. We know that, you know, Bitcoin uses a lot of power, but increasingly we know it's an increasing amount of renewables being used. And we know that, for example, that gold mining is, you know, and banking uses a lot of power too. So, and you know, China banning Bitcoin. I think South Park's even done a skit on that one. It's sort of thrown out whenever they want to drop the price. It's one of those things. So you do see some reason why some of these influencers almost feel like there's a bit of a conspiracy against the technology. And I think we do see that with some of the senior, you know, politicians. I think some seem very articulate and knowledgeable about the technology. I think some alumnus, I think you probably, you know, it seems, and even Ted Cruz, I think, he mentioned, said some sensible things about it. But you get other people who I sort of feel probably ask questions in some of those Senate inquiries, which indicate they don't really understand the technology. I think the bottom line is that, yeah, it behoves those who make important decisions about this new technology, as was the case back with the internet days, to make sure they're fully appraised of all the you know, the pros and cons, both sides of the arguments, and not to be driven by ideological views about these things, because the internet could easily have been banned if we raised concerns about, I think, certain, you know, rules were passed back in those days which made the internet possible. And if, you know, the legislation had been too harsh back in those days, it might not have evolved to what it is today.
Yeah, it seems like the thing that strikes me there is there's plenty of reasons to understandable reasons for why, you know, society might not adopt this quickly, you know, like just like it doesn't adapt anything very, very quickly. And so there can be, yeah, legitimate, quite understandable reasons and on both sides, like to think more about it. And then, you know, and then there's people that just really don't get it. But the thing that strikes me is I think there can be an element of, because I've invested a lot of money in this thing, I'm very frustrated with it not taking off in the way that it is clearly obvious to me, and that leads to, I kind of joked about this online that I actually had bought a good amount of cryptocurrency and then sold a good amount of that off, and I joke that because I'd done that, I was happy with it going up or down, because if it went up, I was like, oh well, at least I have some, but if it went down, I was like, well, okay, I was smart for selling some off, right? So it was kind of this idea that our trades we make, our gambles we make, can, you know, influence our feelings, and then our feelings can influence our beliefs, and that was kind of the idea I was getting at.
Yeah, I think the general view I have of cryptocurrency is that it needs sensible regulation. I think at the moment, I think there does need to be more regulatory oversight. And I think one of the problems of regulation, it tends to be sort of chasing, technicalities to do what's a security and what's not, as opposed to just fundamentals to do with consumer protection, which may be related to that as well. I know. I think that when you see quite a few scams out there, people putting up projects with nameless people there's no real accountability, no sort of clarity about who's doing it, and no clarity about what information's been provided to consumers about the tokenomics and fundamentals of some of these projects. I think that's where people are being scammed, even with what might be considered legitimate projects. I think that's important. And I think for just general advice on there's no easy money in the world. Crypto can be gambling, but it can also be investment. And I think what everything converges on is that everything has to be taken with a long-term perspective, that like with shares of the technology-based shares of the late 1990s, they went up and down, crashed, went up again. People have to look at sort of fundamentals, look at research things properly, and take a longer term perspective, like an investor, rather than and if they are going to do any sort of speculation or short term, it should be small value, what people can afford, and knowing that is like gambling, that you would expect to lose your money, and that any sort of short term gains really should be put into the safer longer term plays. And I think Bitcoin probably, and Ethereum, and some of these top protocols probably will be around in 5 years, but as people often say, when you look back to what was popular in the top 10 in 2018, many of those coins have gone, and that could happen with some of these very promising protocols people have great faith in now.
Paul and I got a late start for our talk due to some tech issues, and I didn't get a chance to ask him all the questions I was curious about. But I emailed him some of those questions, and he sent me some responses, so I'll just read a few of his thoughts here. One question I sent him was, regarding day trading, I think it's not appreciated how much day trading can be tied to problem gambling. I personally know someone whose father was a day trader who lost all their family's money and ran up debts and ruined his children's credit scores by taking out debts in their name. How big a problem is problem gambling when it comes to day trading? Paul wrote back, the two behaviors are related. Those who engage in gambling and or day trading are statistically more likely to engage in the other activity. This is part due to third variables, such as gender, higher social economic status, often higher education, and impulsivity. There will be many day traders or technical analysis guys who hate gambling, but being a gambler and a day trader would pose some risk because the trading is likely to be more like gambling. End quote. Another question I sent Paul was, with the advance of the internet and trading algorithms and machine learning and such, it would seem to me to be almost impossible for day traders to have an edge unless they were very skilled. Am I wrong on that? If I'm right, does that mean that almost everyone who engages in day trading these days, all the amateurs who do that and who aren't professionals, that almost all of them may have a problem? Paul responded, some can do it, but it's rare. Kahneman talks about this in Thinking Fast and Slow. The best performers are often not the same from 1 year to the next because trading performance is not consistent. Amateurs are unlikely to do well from this. The top guys who do okay tend to profit from having inexperienced people who provide the liquidity, who buy high and sell low. So a lot of it is simply being better than others versus actually really being all that good in technical terms. The extreme volatility and insider knowledge of what is likely to pop is what gives the most experienced people the edge. They also have research teams who are doing the background work, for example, following discords, to see what is likely to be appealing to retail investors. End quote. A small note here that what Paul says about experienced operators profiting from inexperienced operators who provide the liquidity is much like the poker world. The main reason it's possible to be a professional poker player is just that so many people overrate their skills at poker and just don't see all the angles and complexity involved. And that's what allows the more experienced players to reap their profits. Another question I sent Paul was, how much of a role does ego and Dunning-Kruger type effects play in problem gambling? One thing that strikes me about problem gambling and poker and day trading and such is that because they are such complex endeavors with so many factors present and such swings present even when you're very skilled, because of those things, it's easier to convince yourself that you're just getting unlucky, that you are skilled but are just having bad luck. The complexity of the endeavor makes it possible for some very smart people to have a problem and not realize it, or be more easily able to avoid facing that anyway, in a way that wouldn't be possible for simpler endeavors like slots or blackjack. Do you agree with that, and can the complexity of the game be a big factor in problem gambling? Paul wrote the following. Yes, that can play a role. One reason I follow some of the influencers is that they are very bright and rational and experienced. For example, Ben Cohen, James from Invest Answers, Rob from Digital Asset News. They play it quite safe, very long term. Ben calls technical analysis dubious speculation. They stick with the big projects only and only put small percentages into more speculative stuff, take profits, buy low. Many of the top guys were caught in 2017 and 18 and admit openly to their mistakes and have learned from them. I don't see a lot of the Dunning-Kruger effect in crypto. Anyone who is very confident and sure is probably going to get wrecked. Another question I sent was, an interesting aspect with crypto is how much social media may be playing a role. Social media, as we've seen with things like the Arab Spring and the George Floyd-related protests, is a powerful tool for focusing a lot of people's attention on something. It allows for a sustained focus on something across a large population for a long period of time in a way that just wasn't possible pre-internet. And the internet is kind of a weird place because it's a distorted view of things in that a relatively small number of people can give a perception that something huge and important is happening. And that sustained emotional focus can have other effects, like leading bystanders to have a fear of missing out and leading people to think that because many people are passionate and confident about something, that it must be something real and exciting, things like this. So I'm curious how you see social media as affecting people's cryptocurrency behaviors and maybe digital addictions in general. Paul wrote the following. Yes, definitely. Social media is not playing much of a role at the moment because a lot of the retail interest is gone from the market. However, when the market goes up, then retail comes back in and social media explodes. There will be thousands of videos with people promoting the most speculative of coins. The dodgy ones are those who promote tokens which they picked up at low prices and IDOs and which retail is now buying at a much higher price. It's a complete conflict of interest. I see some influencers promoting projects that they provided venture capital for. The most risky videos are those telling you to buy coins. If the coin is known, then it probably has already gone up and therefore is riskier. End quote. I sent Paul this question. I talk a good amount on this podcast about political polarization and the psychological dynamics that drive that. It's interesting thinking about how cryptocurrency, like any hot topic really, is subject to people being polarized around, especially by people who might see some benefits to amplifying polarization and harnessing and using that anger. You can see a bit of this recently with Ted Cruz tweeting that the left hates cryptocurrency because they can't control it. But there are, of course, plenty of people on the left who are into cryptocurrency, and it's easy to see how there are aspects of cryptocurrency that would be appreciated by people on both political sides. It's also easy to see how polarization could go the other way because conservatives are historically the party that has, for moral reasons or reasons of national security, tried to crack down on online gambling and such, or even just because billionaire Republicans like Sheldon Adelson, who own brick-and-mortar casinos, are against online gambling. I'm curious if that's something you've thought much about at all, how cryptocurrency might become an even more politically contentious and anger-inducing thing in the future. Paul responded, yes, it's very politicized. Ted Cruz and Senator Lumnus and a few others have been pretty sensible on crypto, but some politicians have been off the mark. Trump made silly comments about it being a threat to the U.S. dollar, even though U.S.-pegged stablecoins are central to crypto. Elizabeth Warren keeps talking about crime and the environment, even though Bitcoin uses less power than dryers, gold, and banking, etc. And it's very hard to commit money laundering using blockchain. Cash is preferred. The EU is making very bad decisions about private wallets, just making it possible for hackers to rob people, and seem to forget that cash in people's physical wallets doesn't need any special permission. Trudeau has destroyed a lot of faith in democracy with his actions. Fancy threatening to freeze bank accounts for people who supported a largely peaceful protest. And this has strengthened the Bitcoin narrative. End quote. This has been an episode featuring psychology researcher Paul Delphobro. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. To learn more about this podcast, go to behavior-podcast.com. If you've enjoyed it, I'd hugely appreciate a rating or review on iTunes or another podcast platform. I don't make any money on this podcast, and I spend a good deal of time and effort on it, so any way you can help me is greatly appreciated. Sharing episodes with your friends and family is also hugely appreciated. If you want to show some financial support, I have a Patreon at patreon.com/Zach Elwood. That's C-A-C-H-E-L-W-O-O-D. If you donate to my Patreon, I'll send you some occasional updates on projects I'm working on and ask your opinion, things like that. And if you're a poker player, just a reminder that I've done some PokerTells work, and you can read about that at my site, readingpokertells.com. You can follow me on Twitter at @apokerplayer. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.